Good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. This is February 28, 2012, Tuesday afternoon. Let the record reflect, it's approximately 3:34 p.m. this afternoon. We do have a quorum with us here today. Present to my immediate right, co-chair Senator Wagner. Also on my right, Senator Wilikowski. Starting at the far end, we have Senator Stevens, Senator McGuire, and Senator Stedman. Senator French is presenting a bill, as I understand, in another committee and will soon be joining us. I am Senator Paskven. We have before us the committee substitute for Senate Bill 192. This is version / B as in boy. And today we are hearing invited testimony from three of Alaska's resource trade associations. We have the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, also known as AOGA. We have the Resource Development Council, also known as RDC, and the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, which is also known as the Alliance. Between these three organizations, they represent a broad cross-section of Alaska's oil and gas industry and many men and women who work in that industry. Before we get officially or formally started, on behalf of the committee, I would like to thank the Finance Committee for allowing us to meet here at this time, 3:30, and also at 6:30 tonight. So we do thank the Finance Committee co-chair, who happens to also be on this committee. With that, though, without any further delay, Kara Moriarty, if you would please step forward, and we welcome you to Senate Resources Committee, and we look forward to your presentation. So please, for the record, state your name and affiliation, and then the floor will be yours.
Thank you, Senator. So Co-Chairman Paskven, Wagner, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, or as the Senator said, commonly referred to as AOGA. I do thank you very much for the invitation and opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 192, specifically the committee substitute, or CS, that you all adopted last Friday as your work draft, and as the Senator mentioned, it's referred to as version B. Before I get into the specifics of the bill, I'd like to take a few moments, especially for those watching at home, to describe AOGA, our diverse membership, and our process in evaluating public policy proposals before we take a position. AOGA is a professional business trade association whose mission is to foster the long-term viability of the oil and gas industry for the benefit of all Alaskans. We currently represent 16 member companies that represent the breadth and scope of the oil industry in Alaska. So starting in Cook Inlet, you'll see a picture of a lease map. These are leases of AOGA members only. And we represent companies with both an onshore and offshore presence in the inlet.
If I could just interject for one moment. The public hearing tonight begins at 6 p.m. I may have misspoke. Oh. But then also we have in the audience Senator Giesel, and I just wanted to recognize that she's here, as is the custom and practice. We like to identify the public officials that are in the room. So anyway, please continue.
Thank you. As I mentioned, we represent longtime employers in the inlet with Marathon and Tesoro. We also represent two of the newest players in the inlet, Apache and Hillcorp, as well as XTO, who have been producing from two traditional platforms. The platforms have been in the inlet for a long time, but XTO has been producing oil from those platforms for the last several years. So geographically, moving to the northeast, to Valdez, we represent one of the smallest refineries in the United States, PetroStar, and the largest employer in Valdez, Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. So moving up the Richardson Highway to my old hometown of Fairbanks and North Pole, we have three members there with the North Pole refinery that PetroStar operates, as well as this is a picture of Flint Hills' refinery in North Pole. And Alyeska continues to maintain a significant office and workforce in the Fairbanks area. We represent companies with interests all across the North Slope, both onshore and offshore. from legacy companies such as BP and Exxon to the two newest producers, Pioneer and Eni Petroleum, and the newest explorer, Repsol. And although Chevron divested its assets in Cook Inlet, it still holds interests in the North Slope. Finally, we also represent Shell and Statoil, who are focused on developing federal resources. All told, AOGA members hold active leases for more than 1.2 million acres of state land. There is little doubt that we represent the majority of oil and gas exploration, production, development, transportation, refining, and marketing activities in Alaska. One of the key purposes of AOGA, or any professional trade association, is to provide a forum for the discussion of matters of general interest to its members. And it is the policy of AOGA, and I'd like to remind the committee and the public, that before we take a position on tax matters, we have to have 100% consensus of all of our members. AOGA did not support the changes that were made to the production tax system in 2006 and 2007. We believe then, and we believe now, that the current tax system makes Alaska uncompetitive for investment dollars for long-term development and production. All of my member companies, from explorers like Repsol to refineries like Flint Hills to producers such as Pioneer and BP, they all believe meaningful changes to the tax system are necessary to stem the decline in oil production. So we have been asked today to give our opinion of the CS before you, and were asked if my member companies believe that this CS will, quote, move the needle, unquote, in making Alaska more competitive and a better place to do business. AOGA does not support this CS. Not one of my member companies believes that this work draft results in meaningful tax reform. The CS proposes to make slight changes to the progressivity provisions of the production tax system. One of the most egregious provisions of the current tax is the fact that as the price of oil increases and as a higher tax is implemented, all prior dollars are taxed at that higher rate. One approach to address this is through a bracketing concept that sets tax rates at different levels as the price increases, so that each level is taxed only once, setting a specific rate for each bracket, thus moderating the impact of the different tax rates. The CS does nothing meaningful to change this onerous provision, thus continuing an imbalance in the risk-reward investment environment in Alaska. It does not improve Alaska's competitiveness, and although we have billions of barrels of reserves, this CS does not create a business climate where the rewards can be commensurate with the risk. The Senate Bipartisan Working Group recently issued a press release outlining what the caucus wants from oil reform. In it, the caucus stated three things. One, increased oil production. Two, more jobs for Alaskans. And three, sustained state revenue over the long term. We support all three of those tenets, but in essence, those three boil down to just one, increased production. Without increased production, it will be difficult to have sustained revenue. Without increased production and revenue, jobs throughout Alaska are in danger. And as I stated earlier, AOGA does not believe this CS will increase production. Without bold and meaningful reforms, Alaska's production will continue to decline at a rate that, according to the Office of Management and Budget, creates potential deficits as early as 2015 and growing larger in each succeeding year. From AOGA's perspective, we have a production problem that will soon result in a serious revenue problem for the state. In 2006 and 2007, many companies testified that ACEs would not attract the investment Alaska needs to change the production curve, and you haven't. In fact, production is significantly lower today than what Alaska was forecasting when it passed ACEs in 2007. one only needs to look to Cook Inlet for guidance. Co-Chairman Wagner, Senator McGuire, many members of the legislature reacted to Cook Inlet production concerns with bold and meaningful tax reforms targeted at making Cook Inlet commercially attractive. And by all accounts, these reforms seem to be successful. Alaska needs to appreciate the North Slope production problem with the same level of concern and react with similar, bold, and meaningful reforms. We believe the overall government take in Alaska is too high, and we have supported the components in the governor's proposal as a first step in providing meaningful reform. Tax policy does affect business decisions, and this CS will not improve my board members' ability to attract investment dollars to compete at the board table that are the investment dollars that are needed to change Alaska's course. The competition for these dollars is real, and we encourage the committee to put Alaska in a better and more competitive position. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to try and answer any questions that the committee may have.
Any questions for Kara? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. You said this bill was a good first step. And what other steps do you think would be necessary if I'm sorry, you said that HB 110, I think, was a good first step. What other steps would you think would be needed if we were to pass a bill like HB 110?
Well, we stated in 2006 and 2007 that, first of all, the base rate is too high, and we still believe the base rate is too high. But we also believe in the provisions of the governor's bill specifically addressing progressivity, extending small producer tax credits, lowering interest rates. It has to be a comprehensive change to our tax structure.
I don't know if you've had an opportunity to review any of the amendments that have been filed, and I'm just curious if there were any amendments that you supported or specifically opposed.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. We have briefly looked at the amendments, but our membership is uncomfortable coming to a conclusion on those amendments until we know how they would fit in a complete package, because I think Chairman Pascavan has stated many times there are several levers, and so we only examined what we have before us in the CS.
Thank you. Senator Stedman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just kind of curious in the reference to Cook Inlet. It appears that Cook Inlet is would satisfy the organization, but my concern is from the Treasury perspective, when you look at Cook Inlet, we've got huge capital credits, and we have virtually nothing on the other side for tax revenue. So Cook Inlet, in my opinion, currently is broken, but it's broken in the opposite respect that north of the Brooks Range. And I understand, you know, that there's a timeline of 2022 when some of those tax changes expire, and some of that are those credits and reduction in taxes was a policy put in place to stimulate Cook Inlet. But my understanding today is that the Treasury is running negative cash flow out of Cook Inlet.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Stedman. You know, we are looking, you can look at Cook Inlet as a guidance. I'm not saying that, we're not advocating that you take the Cook Inlet model and automatically adopt it to the North Slope. They're two different geographic and geological basins, and I think that you do need to look at them separately. We're not advocating for any changes in Cook Inlet. We're just saying that there were changes that were made to spur exploration and development in Cook Inlet for that basin, and we would hope that the same thing would apply on the North Slope.
If I could, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
But you're not advocating that the Treasury run negative in Prudhoe and Kuparuk.
We're through the chair, Senator Stedman, we're advocating for the right balance for the state and the industry.
Okay. When you use the term government take, excuse me, government take, and you indicated that it was too high, and what I was interested in is what is your understanding of government take, for example, at $100 ANS crude pricing under current cost structures, or $120 ANS crude pricing at current cost structures?
Senator Pascavan, I don't have those figures right in front of me. I do know that that as, you know, based on some of the slides that you saw from the Department of Revenue yesterday, we view government take as total government take. So federal government take and all of state revenue. So royalty, production tax, corporate income tax, and property tax. And today we are at the government has a much higher take today than they had 5 or 6 years ago.
And again, within that concept of government take and including the federal government portion, what do you believe is an acceptable government take?
Senator Pascavan, we don't have a magical number of what is acceptable. That, like I mentioned with Senator Stebbin, it has to be the right balance. We think we're out of balance right now. You know, Governor Hammond used to advocate for a third, a third, a third. We're not close to that standard that the state and industry used to be under. I'm not saying that that's the perfect standard, but we need to have a more competitive environment.
Any further questions, Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The governor and the revenue commissioner said recently that he believes the state is, that ACES is competitive, the current alt tax structure is competitive at $60 to $80, and that we get high at around $100. Would you agree with those statements?
We believe that even at $60 to $80, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we believe at $60 to $80 there are still some fields in Alaska that are marginal, and the tax rate could still be too high. We do agree with the governor, especially at higher prices, that as the progressivity kicks in, you are taking a higher percentage, and we just believe Alaska could be more competitive.
And then,
follow up, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know where the committee's going or the Senate is headed, but would you, I guess, faced with the choice of passing this bill or passing nothing, what would your position be?
Currently, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we oppose this bill in its current form.
And if I can maybe flesh that out, is there any sort of happy medium between this bill and HB 110 that would satisfy your members?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, until we would see what it is in writing, I couldn't answer that question.
Seeing no further questions, we thank you, Kara, for your presentation.
Thank you, Senator.
We now have Resource Development Council. Welcome. Gentlemen, welcome to Senate Resources Committee. Please state your name and affiliation, and the floor will be yours.
Thank you, Chairman Pascavan, Co-Chair Wagner, members of the committee. My name is Rick Rogers. I'm the Executive Director of the Resource Development Council. And with me today is one of our directors, Mr. Dave Cruz, with Cruz Construction. If I may, I'd like to introduce RDC and go through my comments and then reserve some of my time to allow Mr. Cruz to share his perspective. I think it'll provide a more full perspective from RDC. RDC is a statewide membership-funded organization. But unlike AOGA that you recently heard from, RDC represents a much broader spectrum. We represent the five major resource industries in Alaska, forestry, fisheries, mining, tourism, as well as oil and gas. Our membership is really a broad cross-section of the Alaska business community. In addition to the aforementioned industries, we have communities. We have all 12 regional Alaska Native corporations in our membership. We have organized labor, utilities, support businesses, all these folks that recognize the important role that resource development plays in our economy. We're really grateful that there's finally an opportunity for public testimony on this issue tonight, and RDC is also grateful to the committee to being invited here to speak on RDC's behalf today. I've not prepared any PowerPoint slides. My sense from watching from the sidelines that maybe there's a little PowerPoint fatigue, so I'm going to spare you from a bunch of slides, but we're just going to have a conversation today.
I hope to the more substance, the better, whether they're in PowerPoint presentations or otherwise.
Thank you, Chairman. Today, I hope to emphasize the sense of urgency as well as the broad base of support that I'm hearing from the RDC membership with regard to a meaningful adjustment to the production tax for the ultimate goal of increasing throughput on taps. Some of the most vocal proponents in our organization for oil production tax reform are actually coming from the non-oil and gas members. And the broader business community is really fearful in looking at the decline curve and the acceleration of the decline and what that means for the overall economy in Alaska. We are convinced that ACES in its current form is rendering investment is retarding investment and contributing to an accelerating decline of production on the North Slope. Alaska is sitting on the edge of a fiscal cliff. A sobering outlook can be found in the governor's budget. If you look at the 10-year budget projection in the appendices, it shows several plausible scenarios that show significant deficits in just a few years out. The Senate appears to be focused on imposing the highest tax politically possible on the producers, squeezing the last dollar from productive private sector with an ever-expanding state budget is not going to lead Alaska to a prosperous future. In our view, the long-term discussion needs to be on how to encourage more production. Taxing ourselves to prosperity is not a strategy. Committee substitute SB 192, in our view, will not provide the improved investment climate to change investment behavior and increase production. At least it's an improvement over the prior version, which raised the production tax, but we don't think it moves the needle enough to have meaningful effect. Now, this, I know it's in vogue to quote Pedro Van Mier's presentation, but I'm going to dare do it anyway, because I think he's a very intelligent man and he had some astute observation. He noted a few weeks ago when he spoke to this committee that standing up for Alaska is politically popular, and he also noted that it'll be very difficult to introduce tax changes in the current somewhat unfavorable political climate in Alaska. In our view, this is a historic turning point for Alaska, and we find it unfortunate that rhetoric characterizing tax reform as a giveaway that legislators need to stand up to. We feel like that's mischaracterizing the situation here. From our view, the objective is to empower the private sector to increase Alaska's productivity for the ultimate benefit of the citizens of Alaska. So we're hoping that leadership can explain that to Alaskans, that we can explain that the high tide will lift all ships and that royalties will increase only with increased production. And we're hopeful that the leadership of this committee and the legislature as a whole can overcome what Pedro astutely notes are very difficult political issues. I hope his political observations are overstated and that we don't end up compromising our future for a short-term populist approach. We keep our eyes on the ball, look at the long-term view, and promote legislation that will reverse the production decline in taps. RDC is interested in meaningful results that move the needle, slowing the reversing production decline. As currently drafted, committee substitute SB 192 we don't think will move the needle. If you go back to about 2005 and the tax changes that have happened since then, production taxes have essentially tripled. And that's according to the Department of Revenue's oil and gas fiscal regime on page 25. I think they modeled that at $100 oil. And while I'm not advocating that we go all the way back to where we were in 2005, I think that when we're tripling up and then we're tweaking down, we're not quite getting to where we need to be. RDC does support HB 110 because the industry has told us that that will result in at least $5 billion in new investment, and we think that's meaningful reform that can make a difference in the accelerating decline on the slope. The producers are the ones who are making the investment decisions. For example, ConocoPhillips Alaska, their capital investment is flat in Alaska compared to year over year from 2010 and 2011. Their lower 48 capital investment increased by 104%, and that's from their presentation to this body. The producers have committed over $5 billion in new investment over HB 110. I can't envision a rational corporate strategy that would make those kinds of commitments publicly and then not follow through. That said, there's a lot of different ways to build a mousetrap, and RDC doesn't care who gets credit. We don't care how this, which vehicle this it takes to get this across the goal line. We know there's a lot of different ways to approach this issue, but what we really look to in terms of whether we're hitting the mark or not is, will it result in meaningful investments by the private sector, which is really what it's going to take to turn this thing around and try to, I mean, at first we're just going to have to look to slowing the decline. Hopefully we can flatline it, and then maybe we can actually increase it, but we have to take it one step at a time, and we think we need some meaningful effort. You know, there's a lot of things that we can't do anything about. We can't affect the geology. We can't affect the competitive climate globally. What the state legislature can do is affect the regulatory environment, which we work on through other venues, and then the fiscal regime. And so those are the two, you know, Senator, you talk about levers. Those are the big levers. And then, of course, there's the little levers. So in the interest of time, I'd like to yield my remaining time to our RDC board member, Dave Cruz. Mr. Cruz deferred his trip from the North Slope today in order to convey RDC's sense of urgency regarding meaningful tax reform. Dave is experiencing firsthand the effects of non-competitive climate on capital investment on the North Slope. Without getting too detailed, Dave is a lifelong Alaskan. He's been involved in construction and resource development since 1976. He's the president and CEO of Cruz Companies, a 31-year-old company based in Palmer. Dave is a member of the RDC board, as well as a board of the Matt Subaru Port Commission. He served as past president of the Associated General Contractors of Alaska. And RDC is proud that he's agreed to serve on our board, and we're also grateful that he took his time today to supplement my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Before we transition, are there any questions by committee members at this time of Mr. Rogers? Senator Stedman has a question.
Well, kind of a comment and then a question, but the inference that the Senate is interested in the highest possible tax, I don't buy that comment in your part of your presentation. Clearly, that's not the direction we're heading. And if that was, there's simple mechanisms within their tax code, like Argentina has in place, where they take 100% over $60. So that type of an inference, I don't think is even helpful. But if we take a look at the, and there's been discussions on the concern over the tax structure at higher rates. Say, you know, yesterday we had some graphic presentations that went north of $200 a barrel, and clearly it was apparent there that, that the amount of extra profit oil, incremental profit oil, going to the state was substantially more than the industry over that wide range, and that's what we've been concentrating on working on. But on the other end of the scale, the state of Alaska offers a lot of upfront credits dealing with capital costs and immediate write-offs of capital expenditures. And how much, I'm just curious, how much exposure or help do you think the state of Alaska should have in supplementing the cost of capital projects to the industry, if RDC has a position on that?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, first on the first comment, I'm grateful to hear that the Senate's interested, and if I overstated my perception on where I see things going with respect to tax rates, I stand corrected. Second, with respect to exploration credits, we are grateful to see that the committee substitute on SB 192 did not remove or reduce the expiration credits. We think that's an important element. Like I said before, we're taking a long-term view, and incentivizing and encouraging exploration is an important element of long-term production improvements. And so I think we're starting to see the results of that effort after several years of being in place. And the problem with exploration credits is that's a little further out in timeline than we hope to see some more immediate work on the legacy fields with some infield drilling and some other technical and capital investments that might be able to be made in the near term. And also, I'd just like to point out that like Kara mentioned, the levers are all kind of working together. I like the lever term. I hope I didn't steal it from you, Chairman. But they work in concert, and so we can incentivize exploration, but eventually those folks that go out and hopefully find new resource, they're still going to have to bring it into production. So that might be a little far off, but they're still concerned, and they're going to be affected directly by whatever the production tax regime is at that time. But I think you need a mix, and we do need to recognize that there have been some helpful parts of ACES, clearly, that the exploration incentives have done some good things and encouraged some investment.
Follow up, Senator.
Let me try to put a finer point on the question. Should the state of Alaska be in the position it is currently, where we could be facing 100% replication of the industry's capital costs?
With respect to
at high oil prices, in excess of a couple hundred dollars a barrel, which is in the possible range. It hasn't materialized yet, but if it did, we'd be in a position where we would be paying 100% of the capital cost of the industry. Do you think the state of Alaska should be in that position?
I'm not prepared to comment on that. I haven't looked at the effect of what $200 oil does. It sounds like there's probably a lot of distortions that happen at $200 oil that would be worth looking at, including the progressivity.
Follow up, Senator.
Well, I think that's part of the balancing act. I mean, there's a concern that a lot of us have with ACES and the steepness of progressivity and the impact that has on splitting the profit oil. But on the other side of the tax regime, where we're paying a substantial amount of upfront cost to the industry, in the 2013 budget we have on our table now, it's $850 million plus the immediate write-off, and that, in some calculations, is over $1 billion. And that's at $110 a barrel. So as you escalate that, we have a substantial risk exposure, the state of Alaska does, in replacing or reimbursing on the capital costs, and that'll be one of the things that we're going to look at the table. So I don't think it's fair to the state of Alaska to have a request to lower one end of the scale, yet leave the state of Alaska exposed to the other end.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, as my colleague at AOGA stated before me, I think looking at those issues, you need to look as a package. We're not prepared to look at individual pieces or amendments, but obviously finding that balance, finding that sweet spot, that's what we really need to do as Alaskans, so we can have a robust, healthy private sector. We all recognize the important services that the state provides, the infrastructure, the education, the health and social services, the resource management, the permitting. Those are all essential functions, and we need a healthy state fiscal system. We need to find that sweet spot. We need to find that balance. We're here today telling you we don't think we're quite there yet.
Do you have any follow-up?
Well, the previous testimony, I took it as they like Cook Inlet and think we should replicate it, which is we're running a negative cash flow in the Treasury. And then when we look north to the Arctic, we have a whole different set of problems up there. We've got the high progressivity and then the capital cost issues. But clearly the state of Alaska shouldn't be in a position where we pay the industry. I mean, that's just as ridiculous if we take 100% and just had left the industry enough to replace their costs. Neither one of those scales work. So at some point, there's got to be some balance between the industry and the state. We as a resource owner and the industry, you know, developing the resources and being paid well for them. So I am concerned that when we have requests or presentations that from no matter what side of the position you are on, that people look more for a balance. But, you know, the state of Alaska's put over $4 billion coming up into the oil basin, and yet when you open a lot of the propaganda, you get the verbiage, Alaska closed for business. And it's one sector or one section of the tax, in my opinion, of the tax dealing with the oil industry in the Arctic, which is the progressivity area in it. But the inference of being closed for business has, I think, a negative indication throughout multiple industries, down into Cook Inlet, through our fisheries, through our timber, through our mining. And, you know, I fail to see where Alaska is closed for business.
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, I don't think I stated that Alaska is closed for business, but what I did state is that we believe the production tax north of the Brooks Range is it's hampering investment. It's not competitive on a global scale, and we're seeing dramatic decreases and accelerated decreases in production at times when oil prices are very robust and other jurisdictions are actually in declining reservoirs or leveling or perhaps even increasing. One would expect at, you know, $100-plus oil, a lot more activity than we're seeing. And from our view, that's in large part due to the tax regime that we have in place under ACES.
Mr. Rogers, you know, one of the issues that you brought up is this concept, I think, of overall government take, and including in that definition the federal government take as one component of that. Do you have any thoughts on what a reasonable rate of government take is?
Chairman, we have taken the position that we support HB 110, and so if you look at that level of government take, we got behind that. And so I'm not going to give you like a percentage or a number. I know there's differing opinions, but we really need to look at getting somewhere closer to what the governor's proposed before you can expect us to really, it's just about what the industry is going to commit, how far we have to get before we're going to see a commitment of capital and a reinvigoration of the activity on the North Slope.
So if I understand, you don't have a rate that you've analyzed as being reasonable, so below that rate, you accept it, and above that rate, you reject it.
Well, the revenue curve for HB 110 we've accepted, and so
I'm talking about the government take analysis.
Okay, but you combine that with the royalty and the federal taxes and the property taxes, and you'll have your total government take.
Let me go back to your reference to the oil and gas fiscal regime publication by Department of Revenue. And in there, you reference that $29 figure as a trebling under ELF. Have you performed the analysis under current cost structures to see what the ratio is under current cost structures?
No, I have not. I relied on the Department of Revenue for the information in their publication. And the point there was just to kind of show the relativity that we really have made some significant changes over the last 5 years, and we think we overshot the mark, and we need to make some changes in the other direction that are significant, perhaps not going all the way back to where we were in 2005, but somewhere in between.
Senator McGuire has a question.
Thank you. And I don't actually, Mr. Chairman, I just have a point on Cook Inlet with deep respect to the chairman to my right. We're going to run the numbers for Cook Inlet, but I think it's important to point out that industry has paid over $73 billion in royalties as a result of renewed activity in Cook Inlet. So perhaps on the severance side, when we're talking about credits, there's a discussion to be had, but I think it brings up a broader philosophical point, and perhaps Mr. Cruz will get to it, which is that the goal shouldn't always be to bring money into the government. And I think that was the comment from Kara Morty at the beginning of this hearing, is that what we're seeing in Cook Inlet is somewhat like a mini North Dakota renaissance. You've got car dealerships that were on the edge of failing that are now in a growth position. You've got housing rates that have gone up. The value of a house in that region has gone up. You've got support industry hiring more and more Alaskans. And so I know that we consider those things, but just to say them out loud, that part of setting a good tax policy in a capitalist society is finding that balance between allowing dollars to flow in the private sector and those jobs to be created there, that we're not all going to work for the government, thank goodness, and that the more money we take into the government, the bigger it gets, because the needs are seemingly infinite. And so I think that's part of what we're talking about here today, is that there are things we can do in tweaking our tax code that will incentivize that private sector development and allow money to flow there. So I just, not to be too defensive about Cook Inlet, but to be somewhat defensive about it. We'll talk about the numbers later, but I'm pleased with what this committee did in passing 309. I think it's been really good for the state, and I think it is relevant when we think about what's happening in the North Slope.
Mr. Rogers, I think that's the not a question before you, but so, Mr. Cruz, I think you're... Floor is yours.
All right. 36 years ago, I graduated high school and got an opportunity to work on the pipeline. I drove trucks for Fluor and then worked as an equipment operator for Kodiak oil field haulers. In my R&Rs from the North Slope, I helped an older gentleman who was in construction, an independent contractor, and thought, hey, I can do this too. If you're running your own business, you determine your own destiny. 31 years ago, I launched what is now Cruz Companies, and I added a partner in 1983, my wife Dana. We currently provide well-paying jobs for 93 people in Alaska and 110 people in North Dakota. My company builds ice roads, provides drilling support services, tundra transport, and mobile camps in Alaska, as well as private and public heavy civil construction, roads, airports, and tug and barge services. In North Dakota, we provide drilling support, rig moving, heavy lift cranes. We went to North Dakota because of no work in Alaska 17 months ago. Cruise companies and all the jobs it has generated wouldn't have happened if Alaska didn't have a healthy oil industry. The oil industry in Alaska isn't healthy now. People in Alaska are losing their jobs because of this. Talented people are moving to other states for better opportunities. Every Alaskan is a stockholder in the oil industry. Some people believe the oil companies are holding out on us and should suffer. I don't believe that. I think the oil industry provides the foundation for the state's economy, for companies like mine, generating countless direct and indirect jobs. Oil pays for 90% of state government. There's not another source of income in our state that is close to being as significant as oil. Steve Forbes, editor-in-chief in Forbes Media, spoke last month at a meeting of the Anchorage Economic Development Corp. Forbes criticized Alaska's oil tax structure, saying it was one of the world's worst, second only to North Korea. We've lost 18% in oil production over the last 3 years. In that period, I've flown down here to Juneau to talk to a lot of you folks about needing to do something about these oil taxes to get our industry healthy again. House Bill 110 would remedy tax provisions strangling the oil industry here in Alaska. The governor supports the bill, and industry bought into this bill. But nothing has happened in the Senate on this bill since it passed the House in April 2011. The governor, House of Representatives, and the oil companies all agreed this bill would breathe new life into Alaska's oil industry. I don't care if it's an SB or an HB as long as it has the provisions that HB 110 does. I do not support this CS that we're talking about today. In exchange for lowering taxes, the oil industry has offered a $5 billion investment to increase our production. You guys did not move on it. You wanted to study it more. Legislators went to Norway to look at their model, when really we needed to go look at the lower 48 model. Even during a recession, seems to be working well. Here are the Baker Hughes rig counts from the lower 48 states that are more competitive because they do not have high oil taxes. California, 43 rigs working. Colorado, 69 rigs working. New Mexico, 81 rigs working. Pennsylvania, 105 rigs working. Louisiana, 139 rigs working. North Dakota, 187 rigs working. Oklahoma, 198 rigs working. Texas, 920 rigs working. And here's Alaska's rig count as of last Friday, 9. I can tell you 4 of those are sitting idle because I'm working on 3 of them right now. Alberta, Canada provides a glimpse what could happen to production here if you make meaningful changes to our oil track structure. The industry there was idled in 2009. Drilling support equipment was selling for 50 cents on the dollar. Thousands of people out of work. The Alberta government adjusted the tax structure to create incentives to bring the industry back. The industry is rebounding. They're going to drill 11,700 wells this year. 700 rigs are operating there now. There is no comparison between the cost of production in Alaska and the cost in other states. It's very expensive to do business in Alaska. To negotiate a drilling project in Alaska will cost you a couple million dollars in almost a year's time. In North Dakota, you can negotiate a drilling project in a month and actually receive your drilling permit in 1 week from the state. Our competition has a road structure, a rail structure. They can use private land for their ventures. They don't wait on a pipeline to move oil. They truck it to a gathering center and rail to the East Coast every day. They are not trapped in endless mazes of government bureaucracy and buried in paperwork from federal regulators, like our industry is here. Our company in the last 5 years has provided support on numerous exploration wells from Glen Allen, NPRA, outskirts of Kuparik, White Hills, 50 miles south of Prudhoe. Not one well we have worked on has come into production. I checked with my main competitor, asked them the same thing, and their answer was that, not one well into production. In North Dakota, there's a 90% chance that a well we work on will be in production within 60 days when we drill it. In Alaska, that takes years. In 1974, the largest non-governmental employee was the Southeast Alaska timber industry. Multiple sawmills, two thriving pulp mills, thousands of well-paying jobs, legislated out of business. Market did not shut them down. Legislation shut them down. Regardless of whether it was state or federal, it was politicians who did it. History tends to repeat itself. Is this the history you're going to create with the oil industry here in Alaska? Until we stop the decline of the oil industry and gain one barrel more than we had yesterday, we might see history repeated here in Alaska. Governor Wally Hickel taught us we can control our destiny here in Alaska. You can change this. Thank you.
Before we go to any potential questions, the record should reflect that we've been joined for quite a while by Senator Thomas, and we also have Senator Egan here. Are there any others that have? But anyway, for the record, they're here, and as always, they're welcome. So any questions, Mr. Cruz? Seeing none, we thank you, Mr. Cruz, for your testimony. Is that RDC's presentation?
Yes, it is. Again, I would like to thank the committee for hearing us today and inviting us for testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to Mr. Rogers and Mr. Cruz. We now proceed to the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. Mark, come on forward and please state your name and affiliation, and then we're prepared to listen to your testimony.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Mark Hyland. I'm with Beacon Occupational Health and Safety. I'm joined here with Doug Smith from Little Red Services, and collectively we're going to give testimony on behalf of the Alliance. We didn't get so far into it that we discussed who would go first, so I think I'll just go first if that's okay, but I did have some written testimony, and I'd be happy to answer questions. Senator Pascavan and members of the Senate Resources Committee, I appreciate the invitation to comment on this very important topic. My name is Mark Hyland, and I'm a lifelong Alaskan. My wife and I own and operate Beacon Occupational Health and Safety Services. Beacon provides medical, safety, and training services, and our clientele embrace the many diverse industries in Alaska, as well as municipal, state, and federal agencies. This includes many of the contractors, producers, and explorers that represent the oil and gas industry in Alaska. In addition, I have the privilege of being the immediate past president of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. The Alliance is made up of nearly 500 member companies that employ some 38,000 employees. In these two capacities, I hope to share a unique and personal perspective over the oil and gas economy in the state. At Beacon, we see much of the new hires that are heading to the slope for services like physicals, drug and alcohol testing, and safety training. We also provide in-field support of year-round medical clinics, safety professionals, on-site training, and site control services directly on the North Slope. We have full-time facilities in Anchorage, Kenai, and Dead Horse, and employ roughly 250 full-time employees. Our success as an Alaskan-owned, Alaskan-grown company is directly attributable to the major oil producers on the North Slope who have been exceptional corporate partners over the years. This includes BP, ConocoPhillips, and many other of the newer producers and explorers on the North Slope. There is no doubt that there is an increase in overall activity this year with the increased winter exploration and the potential of Shell's offshore activity this summer. However, none of it is going to stem the current rate of decline through TAPS anytime soon. We need to make dramatic changes to our current tax regime if we're going to see the increased investment from the current producers and encourage new future producers to invest in our state. From my point of view at the Alliance, our members are concerned. I mentioned 500 member companies that make up the Alliance, and I want to add some perspective to that. Not all of our member companies work on the slope. Our member companies represent suppliers, engineers, accountants, IT, banks, and many other services that never directly contract with a producer or work on the North Slope, but indirectly support the contractors and producers that do. These Alaskan-based businesses, union and non-union, Native corporations included, are all interested in a strong Alaskan oil and gas economy because we all know the benefits it brings to our state. I began working in the oil field in 1991 during the summers to make money for college. I did all the dirty work no one else wanted to do. I cleaned out tanks, skids, well houses. It was good work and paid well. After college, I was fortunate to begin my career with that small oil field service company, which was based in Fairbanks. They were privately held at the time, but a few years later, they were purchased by Bristol Bay Native Corporation. The late 90s were hard on all contractors as the price plummeted to $8 a barrel. At that time, we were fighting over what little work there was, and I recall thinking if only oil would be at $20 a barrel, everything would be good. Today, oil is roughly $120 a barrel, and contractors continue to fight over work and are continuing to look outside Alaska at new opportunities. I am for jobs, and I am for ensuring Alaska has a bright future. I recognize that there are many hurdles to economic growth in this state. Infrastructure, logistics, cost, and distance to market are some of them. I recognize that within the oil and gas industry, there are many specific challenges that are affecting our opportunities for responsible resource development. These include hurdles at both the state and federal level. Some of these federal hurdles seem to be getting resolved. It is time that we grasp our future and do what we as a state, we as Alaskans, can do to create an investment climate that spurs new investment and production on the North Slope. I know there are billions of dollars being discussed when oil tax reform is considered. I do not take this lightly. I don't want to see profits run from the state, nor do I want to see a bloated state government. I want to see opportunities for Alaskan businesses, and I want to see jobs for Alaskans. I want to see the rate of decline through TAP stop, and I want to see an exponential increase in investment on the North Slope. The current Senate bill does not do enough to encourage this investment. I grew up in Alaska during the tough economic times of the 80s. I have three beautiful young daughters. For the sake of Alaska's future, I encourage you to end progressivity and make Alaska competitive for new investment. I'm happy to take any questions, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mark. Senator Stedman has a question. No questions. So. Seeing no questions,
we'll move on.
Mr. Doug Smith.
My name is Doug Smith, Chairman Bassman. Thank you and the committee members for allowing me to speak before you today. I'm going to give you a snapshot of my business challenges. They're not different than many of our members. And to try to bring this into a little bit of reality for all of us, what we're facing in Alaska beyond state government and beyond the industry. I'm president and CEO of Low Red Services. This company started many years ago in 1983. We employ 140 employees, 70% are Alaska residents, 10% additional are previous residents who've moved out of state while being employed by us. You know, our residents are pretty diverse. We've got people in Fairbanks. I've got an employee for 10 years who lives in Port Lyons. I've got people in Homer, Anchor Point, Sitka, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. We're not a bunch of rail belt employees. We represent a large, broad group who depends on many functions of our state budget. So we do have this, I think, in a pretty good perspective, as this is not an easy problem to resolve, and I appreciate that, but we really do need your assistance and leadership to move us into a better position. Our primary concern is the uncertain future of our industry. You know, in our industry, in my business, we are really challenged with capital decisions. As many of you can appreciate, we heard of capital discussions from credits and all types of capital references going on. Well, in my business, you know, a new hot oil unit is only available from one vendor in Red Deer, Canada, that builds them to our Arctic needs, and they have been building them for many years. It's a $2 million investment. We just took the delivery of one in December, and, you know, a short 3 years ago, the same unit was $1.5 million. And the $500,000 is not related to the price increase in steel or parts. It is the requirement that these facilities in Red Deer are running at maximum capacity due to $24 billion in CapEx going into Alberta last year. There's a big demand on equipment, and prices have gone up. Labor charges, overtime charges, and that's impacting our industry here, my business in particular, with no potential rate increases to cover those additional costs. So, you know, it's creating some challenges for us going forward. When we buy this equipment, it's got a 20-year lifespan. And it's hard for any of us to see ahead 20 years and say, is that a good decision or not? But, you know, a lot of our decision is based on some fiscal certainty. And I try to compare our business to an oil company. It's very difficult, but we receive a rate from our customers on that piece of equipment. And if I could forecast that in 5 years that rate was going to be declined by half, I probably wouldn't make the capital expenditure. So I think whatever we do as a state, you know, we need to bring some certainty into our fiscal policy to allow for long-term projects and long-term investments to make a return, which they're based upon when they're evaluated. You know, I'm not a Conoco employee, and I'm not speaking on their behalf, but I wonder if CD5 would actually pass measure right now before the board if that was not already underway before ACES became in effect. You know, I think we got to look at these things and say, how do we not only attract but stimulate investment, not only through our fiscal policy, but assurances that it be stable. You know, another issue, and I think some of you can appreciate this, is how far does this tax issue reach beyond the borders of Alaska? You know, a lot of companies right now have had price concessions over the last few years, even though oil prices are going up. Our costs are going up, but due to the declining production, increase in taxes, oil companies are forced to find ways to reduce cost, and we're one of the places they come to. And while we're seeing reduction in available revenue for our services and a shrinking market, we're seeing costs in healthcare go up. We're seeing our costs in labor being driven up by competing with other sectors that are a lot more active, like North Dakota and Lower 48. And these things bring challenges to the industry. And really, why should this committee care if Little Red Services survives or not? You know, it is a free market environment. But, you know, our company provides a very unique service. One of the things we do is, we freeze protect flow lines and wells when they're shut in. And last January, as you guys recall, last year, we did a lot of freeze protecting on a lot of flow lines and a lot of wells so they could restart. And we've got to have a robust, healthy, viable service industry, or it doesn't matter what we do with taxes on the oil industry. BP and Conoco and Exxon do not put oil in the pipeline without our services. So we really need to think about our challenges, too. And they're not on the same magnitude in billions of dollars, but they're real, and they're real business challenges that we have to face every day. As far as extending beyond the state, we're looking for ways to reduce our cost. And one of the ways easy to our company right now is to refinance our senior debt. Money is cheaper right now than when our last loan was acquired. And the number one question we're getting now as we prepare our bank books from banking institutions as far away as New York is what's going to happen with the tax structure in Alaska? How's that going to affect your futures of business and your cash flow? And those are difficult to forecast right now. So those are the kind of issues that small businesses are going to face in Alaska. And we just ask that you consider that when you're making changes or proposed changes or looking at the tax issue in a broad base. Thank you. I appreciate your time, and I'll answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Senator Stedman has a question or a comment.
Kind of a question, comment. I mean, I hear what you guys are saying, and that's one of the, as far as employment being down, there's, you know, increased cost issues which factor into the discussion and the impact of progressivity and losing the labor pool. Clearly, you can look at the timber industry as an example. You couldn't start it today if you had to in Southeast because there's not very many loggers left. But we get conflicting information. For instance, a decline in employment where we went out and looked at the employment in the oil basin, and the employment's at its maximum. So it's not that there's not employment. The concern is, what are they doing? And are they doing what we needed to do to get, you know, more incremental production? And then if we look at capital expenditure forecasts, there's been discussion, well, the capital expenditures are going to go through the floor. Everything's going to come to a screeching halt. Well, DOR has the industry give them expectations of capital expenditures going forward. And between 12 and 2015, that's going to increase in the projections from 2.7 to 3.8 billion, almost 3.9 billion. So the capital expenditures are forecasted to increase. So there's, you know, as we work through this policy adjustment, there's these anomalies that stick out that don't fit into the general conversation of you know, employment going down, everybody going to North Dakota, that type of stuff. The other point I'd like to bring out just is kind of how things get conflicted when we ask the barge service companies and the freight companies, what are they bringing to Alaska and what are they taking out? You know, you bring in pipe and equipment, and are you taking out wore out junk? Because everything has to be barged in or out, or taken in on freighters. That points to the direction of not enough work going in to enhance our oil recovery. You know, in other words, the dollars going into maintenance and those type of things that we're struggling with. So we are concerned about what is going on in the oil patch. You know, we've been told that the bunkhouses are full, the planes are full, got the place stuffed with people, and you know, the processing facilities are running at capacity. So we're struggling with that as we try to formulate this policy adjustment. I think everybody's concerned about the decline in oil production, which has been going on since 88 or some number back in there. And clearly, we don't want to lose our workforce. We don't want our guys going to North Dakota or Texas or anywhere else. We want the jobs to stay here in Alaska. So anyway, just kind of a more of a comment, but it's not, the issue isn't just black and white, push a button, and if it was that easy, we would have probably never got here in the first place.
Yes, I thought you'd have an opportunity to respond, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. I know, and I agree, this is a very difficult process for the general public at large, and even if you're close to the industry, to fully get your arms around. You know, I find myself spending, Sunday I read all 17 of the proposed amendments to CS-192. I'm not a tax attorney. I should be if I really want to understand the implications of that. I need a whole division to somehow run the numbers and tell me what that means to revenue. And so I'm at a disadvantage where I've got to rely on Department of Revenue products and other things that is put out by the legislature to understand what are we negotiating here as a state, as residents, where it's about us. It's not about anybody but the residents of Alaska. And it's hard to get your arms around that. So I will say that there's a lot of issues out there. I don't agree with having been at the forefront of our discussions. My employment's been relatively flat for the last 3 or 4 years. We took a temporary dip in 2009 as the price came down with the recession. We lost about 10% of our employees due to decreased work. We found ways to put ourselves in position to being helped to deliver on new technology in the field that is allowed to add some employment back. We're the ones injecting the bright water polymer for BP to increase oil recovery from existing wells by redirecting water flood. So we're trying to be creative. I mean, we didn't achieve where we're at in business by not trying to find our way out of a bad situation. And it is true, you know, employment has, I think the numbers are accurate, they're high. My camp is relatively full. It's our own personal facility. I have been approached about, do I have rooms available? So I see the activity level representing something different than what the production decline represents. You know, I try to boil it back to what's really of concern to me most as a business and a resident here is what is our production decline today, what could it be, and when can someone get the forecast right? You know, my concern back when we were looking at ACES versus today, that those projections are about 100,000 barrels off from Department of Revenue of what oil production would be today when we evaluated ACES. And I think if people had a crystal ball, sometimes we'd make great decisions. And I'm not sure ACES would have been the decision point had we had a perfect projection of what was going to happen in our economy or our production levels. And I think as we look forward, we got to take a conservative estimate on what that looks like and give this our best shot to get our state in a more competitive posture.
Mr. Smith, you know, is your business eligible for that capital expenditure credit? In other words, I assume you're talking about a camp, and so what I understand is that if you construct something, there's potential for credits. I assume the answer to that is no.
I would love to have a credit, but the bottom line is, you know, I think all of us are united in not wanting a subsidy, a handout, or anything that would put our state at paying 100% of the tab. I think there's a fair level. Once we pay the federal government their due, what's remaining should be fairly split between industry and the state. And it should be a level at which we measure the success solely on the production decline. And hopefully, I mean, I would be ecstatic to see our production level out. I don't have visions that we're going to find 1 million barrels a day without some significant changes in what we're producing from as far as reservoirs. But to simply see a flattening of our current decline curve for a few years while we find our feet on other areas of development, I think would be a win for us.
Just one more. You know, I understand that CapEx component, but I also have heard that back in 2008 when the prices of oil went up to $140-some a barrel, that the pricing of all the support structures, the costs dramatically increased, and then when you had that dramatic decline in oil prices in 2009, that then the major oil industry said, we got to put a squash on these high pricing that of all the support structure that was around it. And so to speak, for the years that followed, that there was a suppression of pricing, so to speak, because it just got out of control. Is that?
Yeah, I can actually provide you copies of our contracts. Today's prices on a hot oil unit per hour are less than what we charged in 2004. So some industries may have made it through the supply and demand curve to elevate pricing. I think some that maybe over-escalated prices are currently being punished or seeing themselves at the back of the line for escalating prices more progressively than what was fair based on the market. But a lot of companies did not participate in a run-up of cost. And, you know, I think if you want to be a long-term partner here in the state with industry, you have to treat them like a partner. And that means we expect the same in return from them, which is a mutual respect that, you know, we do have mutual ground that we can agree upon that serve both of us. And I think you're better off to be a partner as our motto and not a pickpocket. And I think as a state, we got to choose how we're going to be, a partner, or are we going to tax too much where we drive our industry out? And I believe that's something that you guys have to use the wisdom and all these charts that you understand to find out what is our best opportunity to put forth, and I hope we see something soon.
Senator Stedman had a question.
Yeah, I just noticed that you had the charts from Department of Revenue yesterday at the Resources Committee, which I think is good that you guys take an interest to look at the presentation information. But those are for the legacy fields. They don't include everybody up there, so the numbers will change a little bit, but that should give you a pretty close estimation of what the big three face. And there has been discussion on, you know, do we set up we got to work on fixing ACEs at a high price. But outside of that, there's discussions going on. How do you tax or the incremental oil production to try to flatten the decline curve first and then incrementally get it up to back up to 600 if it drops below that, or to 700. And so you'll see discussions going forward on an allowance. Pedro Van Meer suggested a $25 allowance, which is basically just $25 off the top to the industry on incremental production. There's other methodologies. Senator Wagner's working on one, tax holiday. But there will be discussions on some of that. So we're trying to focus and zero in on what we perceive as the most challenging problem and try to get a solution on that. But there's issues with an ACES that run a lot deeper than we're going to have time to deal with this winter.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think the one thing we try to do as an organization is, you know, educate ourselves so we can remain objective. As you guys may know, we had Pedro come in and present to us prior to his coming here. And it's good to have a lot of viewpoints to draw from and to understand many different angles at which this problem may be resolved. So I think, along with a lot of others who've spoken here today, we don't have any ownership, and if it's a House bill, Senate bill, or what the context exactly is, if it achieves placing us in a really good competitive posture. I'd hate to think that we'd settle for being the fourth best place or the fifth, but get us in a good spot where we can see an opportunity to turn around our decline and hopefully offset some of what we lose in tax revenue with increased production over a longer period of time. And I know it's going to sting a little bit in the beginning, and I appreciate the spot you guys are in dealing with that.
Any further questions from Mr. Hyland or Mr. Smith?
Thank you very much for allowing us to speak. We appreciate it.
We very much appreciate hearing from the Alliance. So given that today we will adjourn this meeting in a moment, but what I want everyone to make sure they remember is that we are here at 6 p.m. in this room. So given that, Senate Resources for this afternoon is adjourned.